Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over 75 million Americans voted to send Donald Trump back to the White House after he ran the most sexist campaign in U.S. history. And just to let you know, we're going to play a number of clips on today's show, and many of them are very offensive. Donald Trump and his surrogates repeatedly used misogynistic language while referring to Kamala Harris. Elon Musk's super PAC ran ads that said Kamala Harris is a C word. They then said the C stood for communism. At one of his rallies, Trump encouraged an audience member who suggested Kamala Harris worked as a prostitute. He reposted a post on Truth Social, implying that Harris traded sexual favors to spur her political rise. At the racist Madison Square Garden rally, businessman Grant Cardone said Harris and her pimp handlers will destroy our country. And then there's the actual sexual assault. In May 2023, a jury ordered Donald Trump to pay advice columnist E. Jean Carroll $5 million after he was found liable for sexually abusing her. A separate jury, awarded her another $83 million after saying he damaged her reputation by calling her a liar for accusing him of sexual assault. Donald Trump has been accused of sexual misconduct by about 24 women. Here are a few of those women in an ad for the Anti-Psychopath Pack.
Women, because I am your protector. I want to be your protector.
You're not going to be in danger any longer.
I did try, but she was married. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Donald Trump shut the door and pushed me up against the wall and bang my head and kissed me. It was so shocking.
Trump leads me to this room, pushes me against the wall, and starts kissing me forcefully.
He pulled me into him. The hands started moving, and they were on the, you know, on the side of my breasts, on my hips, back down to my butt.
Trump suddenly started groping me. He was trying to kiss me, and I'm trying to push him away.
He was sort of touching me all over my body. I pushed him away. He just shoved his tongue in my mouth, started kissing me.
And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
It was not pleasant. It was not welcomed. It was not consensual.
And he put his shoulder against me to hold me against the wall.
I tried to push him. Kept coming back at me.
He was basically overpowering me.
I used my teeth to push his tongue out of my mouth.
I felt sick inside.
He and Jeffrey just kept talking and like looking at each other and smiling.
He started putting his hand up my skirt.
Grab him by the... I can do anything.
And he pulled down the tights. That was when it turned serious.
Donald Trump is an adjudicated sexual assaulter.
Donald Trump is a serial sexual predator. He even says it. He's told everybody, this is what I do. Donald Trump says he's going to protect women. He harms women. He sexually assaults women. He has no respect for women.
We cannot elect this man as president.
Thanks to that ad from the Anti-Psychopath PAC. Now, we know that there are many, many reasons why people voted for Trump. They're angry at Democrats. They're angry about the economy. Many reasons. But at the end of the day, they voted for this, for the most sexist campaign in U.S. history. So what does this say about our society? How should we be thinking about this, talking about this? Where do we go from here? How do we talk to young people, young women, kids, teenagers, our daughters? How do we talk about this? Today, we're joined by Malaika Jabali, a public policy attorney, writer, and activist. Her writing has appeared in many publications, including Jacobin, The Intercept, and Glamour. In a recent piece for The Guardian, she writes, "The sad truth is that anti-feminist backlash has helped propel Trump to victory." Malaika Jabali is author of It's Not You, It's Capitalism, Why It's Time to Break Up and How to Move On. Hi, Malaika. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Leslie Salzinger, an associate professor and chair of gender and women's studies at UC Berkeley. She writes and teaches on gender, capitalism, nationality, and race, and their ongoing co-formations, and is the author of Genders in Production, Making Workers in Mexico's Global Factories. She's also written extensively about the relationship of masculinity and neoliberalism. Hi, Professor Salzinger. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I have a 14-year-old niece, and I got to say, doing research for the show was really tough because I found clips of things Trump said that I've never heard. And we're going to play some of those clips. And a lot of people are saying, you know what? Politicians cheat. Politicians say horrible things. And that's true. But with Trump, it's constant. It goes back decades. It has been documented. And I wonder how you think about this, Malaika, because as I said, we know people have voted for Trump for many different reasons. But at the end of the day, they know who this guy is, and they still voted for this. How are you thinking about this?
I think that there isn't even one story in terms of men and women who voted for him. I do think that there are a lot of people who didn't show up. Black men, for instance, 77% of them voted for Vice President Harris. So I think that there is also a race, a gender and race dynamic here. And so Donald Trump doesn't just appeal to men who are misogynistic and patriarchal. I think there is an entire ecosystem of conservative right-wing talking points that animate people's decisions in voting for the Republican Party, because they're not just there's not just anti-feminist backlash. This also intersects with anti-immigrant backlash. And there is an economic component here that I don't think we should understate. And so when people are feeling strapped, financially strapped and trapped, and younger men, especially Gen Z men, who don't know if this economy is going to work for them, that frustration manifests in different ways. And some of that is through calls to tradition. And Donald Trump isn't just an assaulter. He is someone who represents this idea of a traditional alpha man. And if you are at your parents' home, you can barely afford college. If you can't afford college, and you see this guy on YouTube or Reddit or TikTok, where a lot of young men are getting their news and their political views are being shaped, you're like, I want to be like him. So that economic frustration doesn't automatically translate into misogyny. As I said, a lot of Black men get their news the same way. Young Black men get their news the same way, but they're not going to vote for a party that is also racist and believes in increasing the criminal justice system, which, you know, to be fair, the Democratic Party does as well. Kamala Harris represented herself as the top cop. So a lot of people did stay home. But just going back to the people who did vote for Donald Trump, it also aligns with a conservative worldview overall.
Right. And there's so many, like you say, there's so many layers to all of this and aspects to this. And we're going to do a show about the working class and the Democratic Party. And then what does working class even mean? Because typically people think of, because of major media coverage, you know, white men wearing hard hats. We're going to talk about a much broader section of the working class. So many people of color, Black women, I mean, so many people are included in the working class, and we're going to talk about that in depth. How are you thinking about this, Professor Saul Zinger, just given what we know about Trump and the horrific things he has said about women?
Well, you know, I mean, I really, really agree with everything that Malaika said about you can't really think about gender by itself. It's always co-constituted with race, with class, and all those things were at play in this election. But I think I've been trying to think as a scholar what I bring, because there's so much, I think, extremely intelligent thinking out there about who voted for whom and why. But I think it's helpful to step back and think a little bit when we talk about gender, not just as whether people who understand themselves as women or men voted in a certain way, but how the whole structure is gendered. And by that I mean that our sort of fundamental idea of what leadership is itself is rooted in a binary gender framework. The idea that there are certain kinds of people who are appropriate leaders and certain kinds of people who are not, that those are sort of allocated in terms of gender, and then there's a feedback loop where we assume that gender is a natural thing, that a binary gender is a natural thing, and that feeds into the idea that certain people do certain things better than others. So presidents themselves are, the idea of the president itself is a masculinized and I think also a racialized category. And that makes it very difficult for somebody who doesn't fit that image to step into that role. And one thing that's really striking is if you look at the voting patterns when Hillary Clinton was running and now, around sort of gender differences, it's actually surprisingly similar. Right. And it does make you wonder what it means for Americans to think about somebody who is understood as feminized as inhabiting that role. And what would it take for us to think of leadership in terms of care, in terms of the many other things that obviously government does? The government doesn't just wage war, but there's a sense in which I do think that it's very difficult for somebody who is a woman, especially a Black woman, to be understood as appropriately like inhabiting that space of leadership in this country. And the ironies of that, of course, are huge in terms of Trump himself as a particular person, and honestly, in terms of Harris as well, who is nothing if not a tough person. But there is something about the way gender structures the entire thing that they enter even before the voting starts that I think is part of what's at issue here.
The votes are still being counted on the West Coast, but exit polls show that once again, Trump won white women voters by 8 points nationally. 53% backed him, 45% backed Harris. Trump led with white women by 7 points in 2020. And Malaika, a lot of people thought there was going to be a lot more crossover, and it just didn't happen. People thought it would because of abortion. And while people did vote for abortion rights amendments at the state level, they still voted for the extreme anti-choice Republicans. What are your thoughts about how we should be talking about the white women vote, given what they voted for?
I think it's really difficult. As someone who has studied electorates, particularly since Trump's rise, I think it's really difficult to stray from your voter habits. You know, what makes, I think there are questions that we need to ask. What makes people vote in a way that they might have never voted before? If you're a white woman and the Republican Party has won white women over the last 50 years. So if that has been the case, if that's been the precedent, what will it take for people to vote differently? Black men have traditionally voted Democrat, even when there are times when the Democratic Party doesn't seem to represent the interests of the working class, which a lot of Black people are. So it's hard to say what will motivate, what drives people to do something different if their friends, their community, their churches are continuing to encourage the same kinds of voting patterns that they've always had. So I think that's something that we should be asking ourselves as a Black woman. You know, I think about my own family that has consistently voted the way that they have, even if they're reluctant to. And I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. I think people were surprised, especially because of how Donald Trump ran his campaign. The fact that even if he is this idealized version of a man, when you saw him head to head in a debate with Kamala Harris, with the vice president, he stumbled, he faltered, he a lot of times was talking nonsense. You know, she appeared stronger and tougher and more mentally acute. So she embodied this idea of being a prosecutor, being tough. So I'm not exactly sure how you get people to divert from those patterns.
What would you like to add, Professor Saul Zinger?
Yeah, I mean, I really agree. I really agree with everything Malaika was just saying. And I think part of what's complex about the question of how white women voted is that white women themselves, that's also not a single category. And so we have to wonder, what are the investments of working class white women versus richer white women? I don't think those are identical. And I think sometimes the polls give us this kind of large, gives an image of these unified groups, when actually, if you were to talk to people, you'd get like a very different logic across poorer and richer women. I also do think that, speaking to somebody for whom questions around reproductive justice have been very central to my own politics, that I think it's disturbing but interesting to think that you can read these questions as questions about the sort of fundamental freedom and autonomy and the ability to live in one's own body as one chooses. But I think that some of the votes around abortion seem to be working with a different valence around freedom, the freedom, like people get to do what they want, the sort of choice thing, and that doesn't necessarily lead them to be comfortable with the idea of a woman as a leader, that those are actually quite separate. And then I think feminists have made the mistake of thinking those are the same, and that maybe those are not the same, and that many people are like, Americans get to decide what they want, even women, but that doesn't mean we want a woman leader. And so I think the abortion question broke in a way that actually to me was very surprising, along with, you know, many other people.
Right. Leslie Salzinger is associate professor and chair of gender and women's studies at UC Berkeley. She's the author of Genders in Production, Making Workers in Mexico's Global Factories. Malaika Jabali is public policy attorney, writer, and activist, whose pieces have appeared in many publications, including The Guardian and Jacobin. And she's the author of It's Not You, It's Capitalism, Why It's Time to Break Up and How to Move On. Again, there are so many reasons why over 75 million people voted for Donald Trump. I'm sure you've heard a lot of people analyzing, pontificating on this. At the end of the day, they voted for the most sexist campaign in U.S. history. So what does this say about our society? How should we be talking about this? And it's also important just to remember that about a dozen women have accused him of sexual assault. A jury ordered him to pay E. Jean Carroll $5 million after he was found liable for sexually abusing her. And the Republican Party also got behind this. So I've been listening to so many of the conversations, and I feel like the sexism part of it is just not getting that much attention. And just thinking about what this says about our society, I found this compilation of Donald Trump's misogyny over the years.
Pregnancy is never, it's a wonderful thing for the woman. It's a wonderful thing for the husband. It's certainly an inconvenience for a business. And whether people want to say that or not, the fact is it is an inconvenience for a person that is running a business.
She's a disgusting pig, right?
Hey, oh, I was with Donald Trump in 1980. I was sitting with him on an airplane. And he went after me on the plane. Yeah, I'm going to go after. Believe me, she would not be my first choice, that I can tell you. Man. You don't know. That would not be my first choice.
Well, I just don't respect her as a journalist. I have no respect for her. I don't think she's very good. I think she's highly overrated. She gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no? As a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
If you become president, will a woman make the same as a man? And do I get to choose what I do with my body?
You're going to make the same if you do as good a job. You're going to make the same if you do as good a job.
Putting a wife to work is a very dangerous thing.
The woman from Russia that won, who we fired, I thought was terrible.
She weighed 118 pounds or 117 pounds, and she went up to 160 or 70. So this is somebody that likes to eat.
So again, there he is saying there has to be punishment for women who have abortions. He said that to Chris Matthews years ago. I keep going back to this question, Malaika. I wonder how you're thinking about it. What does this all say about our society, that this is where we're at in 2024? I mean, to think that this powerful Republican Party got behind this man and the people are sending him back to the White House a second time.
I think it's eye-opening, maybe not particularly surprising. I don't, you know, given the fact that Donald Trump got so close in 2020, he actually won in 2016. I don't think it's surprising to a lot of people, but it does open our eyes and raise some questions about what the next steps can be. You know, he is going to be the president for the next 4 years. So how do groups manage that? And again, because I cover electoral politics, I'm often interested in what's done at the local level. And so like Dr. Salzinger was talking about, a lot of these women, even if they may not, I'm thinking of it in the converse way. So even if they might not have been willing to vote for a woman president because of perhaps some internalized misogyny or some ideas about what leadership looks like, if you can mitigate the actual electoral harms through local politics, through ballot measures, through state legislative processes, then at least the effects of that misogyny won't necessarily have political implications. And then if we were to think back 4 years ago, when Bernie Sanders was a pretty legitimate candidate, there were many times when there were national polls, entrance polls, where he was beating Donald Trump in a head-to-head. We had a patriarchal society then. We had 4 years of Donald Trump then, potentially another 4 years. But he was able to capture this anger, this resentment about the system that's largely concentrated in white men. Like, let's be frank in terms of how they vote, because they tend to vote Republican regardless, even if there is a more liberal candidate that's going to meet their needs, or a more left-wing candidate or progressive candidate that's going to meet their needs. Bernie Sanders was still able to attract a lot of those voters without appealing to that misogyny and racism. So however we want to think about people's personal views, it may not always be reflective in their political choices. If they feel like they have a choice, that might address some of those economic things that I think are animating the patriarchy and animating the racism and anti-immigrant views that we see the right wing foment.
To your point, Malaika, many Bernie supporters voted for Trump. I don't know if you saw this last night, but Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked her voters, her supporters, if you voted for me and Trump, because in her district in the Bronx, more people this time around voted for Trump. If you voted for me and Trump, tell me why. And she got a lot of responses. So again, it's not to say that this is black and white. There's so many layers to all of this. But to your point, people are voting for Bernie Sanders and then Donald Trump. The same with Obama. A lot of people who voted for Obama voted for Trump this time around.
Yeah. And I want to add to that, too, because I think, you know, there's also regional differences. So back when I was doing political organizing, my full-time job is as a journalist now, but I was organizing in different battleground states. I was in Ohio, and there is a very distinct class element and class anger that kept a lot of, you know, blue-collar white men from voting for Mitt Romney. Like, they felt that he did not represent their interests. And I'm sure, you know, there are probably some ideas about tradition and what manhood looks like and that they need to be breadwinners. But I do think that in these battleground states where the elections tend to be decided, we don't need to think about transforming the entire country. You know, if we can just get three main states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, to be able to say, oh, I have a candidate who, regardless of how I feel about women in leadership or Black people being in leadership, at least, you know, my bills will be able to get paid. At least I can have a roof over my head and not have to work three jobs for it. There's somebody who recognizes the fact that I'm struggling with these issues and they're not having all these celebrity endorsements and they're not ignoring the fact that there needs to be a change to the status quo. So I don't know if we need to think about it so broadly about the country, because who knows how long it's going to take for us to change our mentality, but those electoral choices don't always have to represent that.
Hmm. Before we go to break, Professor Salzinger, what would you like to add? And I'm wondering what you're hearing from your students about all of this, because I read a piece in CNN just recently, Your Body, My Choice, Attacks on Women Surge on Social Media Following Election. This piece is by Claire Duffy, who writes, sexist and abusive attacks on women like Your Body, My Choice and Get Back to the Kitchen have surged across social media since Trump's reelection, according to an analysis from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. What are your thoughts? And I wonder how your students are talking about all of this.
I mean, gender studies students at Berkeley, I mean, they're upset. you know, I think it is very demoralizing, you know, for the kind of students who we teach. I mean, one thing that really strikes me, and I'm thinking about what Malika was saying as well, and this sort of more general question of like, what does this say about us, about the country as a whole? And, you know, it's really striking that over the last, you know, since the emergence of Trump, that both women as a whole and white women's votes seem kind of remarkably consistent. And men, white men, but not only white men, seem to be moving more and more towards this kind of really bellicose, aggressive form of masculinity that Trump performs. And I think that's really a question that is very central, I think, to thinking about where we go next, is what is happening with men, and maybe especially younger working class men. I mean, if you look at the data, and this is, Malika was talking about this as well, that the centrality of working class white men without a college education, being drawn more and more towards voting for somebody like Trump. And in that sense, I do think that the Democratic Party has really failed to offer a certain kind of economic alternative to people who legitimately feel like they want decent wages, decent jobs, you know, the fall of people of union membership, all those issues, I think, really come together here. But very ironically, of course, because one thing that we do know about the Republican Party is that they're not actually the party of the working class. Hmm. But I think the Democrats have done a pretty bad job at shifting that. And that one thing that also is very striking to me, I think, is if you think about the middle of the Biden presidency, during and after COVID, when there was a real where there really was an investment in care that I think made it possible to produce a different idea of the work that government can do. And this last period, which has been all about war in many ways, in many places, I think has foregrounded again an image of the job of the president as being the leader of the state in terms of violence. And I think that again, ironically, since one thing that Trump does say is it'll end all the wars, but that there's a sense, I did a bunch of door knocking during this election as well, and I talked to a lot of men who said she just cannot be trusted to be the commander in chief. It was like a very straightforward response. And so I think thinking about what's happening with men seems like a really, really important question right now. And I think that's why, you know, Malika's article is, I think, very informative in terms of thinking about the question, not about, when you talk about gender, we're often talking about women, but what is going on with men right now?
Yeah.
Seems like a complex and important question.
We'll definitely do a lot of shows about that also. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Leslie Salzinger, Associate Professor and Chair of Gender and Women's Studies at UC Berkeley, and author of Genders in Production, Making Workers in Mexico's Global Factories. Malika Jabali is a public policy attorney, writer, and activist whose pieces have appeared in many publications, including Jacobin and The Guardian. She's the author, It's Not You, It's Capitalism, Why It's Time to Break Up and How to Move On. Nick writes, fool us once, shame on us. Fool us twice, shame on us. No two ways around the fact America voted for more Trump madness. Sexist, yes. Men and women, guilty. So, sorry, I have to play one more clip because I think it's important for us to realize where we are and how we deal with this. Again, Donald Trump going back to the White House. People voted for this. Here is another compilation of what he has said over the past couple decades.
Watch.
Absolutely.
Well, Marla used to say, I can't believe you're not walking Tiffany down the street, you know, in a carriage, right? Yeah, I'm going to be walking down Fifth Avenue with a baby in a carriage. And it just didn't work.
And you're going to have more kids?
I think so, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, sure. I would.
What do you need that headache for?
Because I like kids. I mean, I won't do anything to take care of them. I'll supply the funds and she'll take care of the kids, right?
And what does that mean, though?
You know, it's not like I'm going to be walking the kids down Central Park.
Yeah. Do you actually change diapers?
No, I don't do that.
See, not good.
Not one, right?
No, I don't do it. It's not my thing. You know what? I'm a good father, but that's not my thing. And Melania's going to be a great mother.
Yeah, but it's no one's thing.
No, but some women, well, to a large extent, it's up to the women. There are a lot of women out there that, you know, demand that the husband act like the wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of husbands that listen to that. So, you know, they go for it.
I mean, all of the men, we're petrified to speak to women anymore. We may raise our voice. You know what? The women get it better than we do, folks. All right? They get it better than we do.
There's something there, right?
Yes.
But you have to like freckles. I've seen a close-up of her chest.
Yes.
And a lot of freckles. Are you into freckles? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're probably right. She's probably deeply troubled and therefore great in bed.
Back in the day.
How come the deeply troubled women?
Yes.
You know, deeply, deeply troubled.
Right.
They're always the best in bed.
Well, not all models, but beautiful women. I tend to like beautiful women more than unattractive women. I don't know. Maybe that makes me bad.
I have days where I think it's great.
Yeah.
And then I have days where if I come home and, you know, I don't want to sound too much like a chauvinist, but when I come home and dinner's not ready, I go through the roof, okay?
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Clips from the 47th President of the United States. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We would love to hear your thoughts about how you would like us to cover the next 4 years under Trump. If you'd like to weigh in on this, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Again, any show ideas, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Malaika Jabali, public policy attorney, writer, and activist, whose pieces have appeared in many publications. In a recent piece for The Guardian, she writes, "The sad truth is that anti-feminist backlash helped propel Trump to victory." Malaika is also author of the book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism, Why It's Time to Break Up and How to Move On. We're also joined by Leslie Salzinger, associate professor and chair of gender and women's studies at UC Berkeley. She's written extensively about the relationship of masculinity and neoliberalism and is the author of Genders in Production, Making Workers and Mexico's Global Factories. We have an email from a listener who says, how do we talk to our children about this, given that some of what we played is played in the media? Malaika, what are your thoughts?
I'm not sure how effective. Yes, I think parents absolutely should have a conversation about what Donald Trump is, and also talk about his policies. Are there going to be policies that impact them as a family? The policies that, even though he won on the partly on the this anti-feminist backlash, he won for other reasons that will probably impact them. So I guess depending on the age of your children, talk about how that might impact their family. Will they be able to actually survive Donald Trump's economy financially? Are they going to be okay? I think the other thing is thinking about the types of media that young adults are consuming. Children are still children at 18 to 29, and many of them are consuming their news on Reddit and YouTube and TikTok, where these ideas, where this patriarchy, where this misogyny is being shaped and fomented, especially for young men. I wanted to add earlier, just thinking about how younger voters are starting to look at the Republican Party as a viable the electoral option for them, there are Gen Z men, 60% of Gen Z men believe that women's equality has gone too far and that it discriminates against men. There's an Ipsos study that came out earlier this year showing that. And that is the highest demographic. That was the highest demographic of men, more than boomers, more than millennials. They were more likely to say that women's equality has gone too far. And I think a lot of them are getting their ideas from alternative media outlets. So there has to be some serious conversations and ways to anti-propagandize, you know, your children and your teenagers and young adults from that ongoing message.
Do you have anything to add on that, Professor Salzinger?
I mean, I think it's pretty hard to talk to children about these questions, not because I think you have to be careful about, you know, not letting them see the terrible things that Trump says. You know, I personally have never been somebody who thinks you have to be that children shouldn't hear hard things. It's just the level of hate that he expresses, I think, is just really startling. And I guess I think at some level, really pointing out the centrality of misogyny, I mean, since we're talking about gender here and this, but also the centrality of racism, the incredible levels of xenophobia, the children, I think, do have a kind of a deep sense of justice. And I think it's important to tell them the truth about the desire of somebody like the desire that Trump stands for to keep some people below other people. I mean, just in a very really basic way. And, you know, to add to what Malika was saying earlier about you know, Gen Z men, I mean, I do think that the question of inequality more broadly, and the way that's economic inequality, that is, and the way that's manifesting among young men, is really, really troubling. And I think we see a sort of toxic brew of these economic problems with a deep misogyny that we really have been very unsuccessful in dealing with, that has to do with the men feeling that somehow they are being pushed aside by women, as opposed to thinking that there's a possibility of a world with space for both. And that does, I think, have to do with the problem of inequality that isn't about gender, but that is about neoliberalism and about the larger structure of the society overall.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because I think it goes back to, I mean, when you're talking about quote unquote traditional men and how society has changed so quickly for so many reasons, they have a hard time with that. And it's sort of like the men taking care of the family, that just doesn't exist anymore for various reasons. So can you elaborate on that? I just don't feel like we talk enough about that.
I mean, I think it is too bad that the moment that we see of increasing inequality that really started in the 70s and that has just grown really quite consistently since then, in which the sort of very top of the American society, and this is in some ways reflected globally as well, has so much more compared to people at the bottom, and that has happened at the same time as we've had shifts in women's movement into the workforce, and we've also had shifts in terms of the kind of jobs that are available to people at the, especially I think, at the bottom of the class ladder, so that service work and care work jobs are more there's a higher proportion of those jobs in the economy than jobs that were more traditionally masculine. And I think the combination of all those things has made it possible for there to be a kind of that the resentment of men who feel like they don't have as much economic access as they had before is directed against women, mm-hmm. as opposed to against the sort of larger structure which has undermined those jobs more generally.
Right.
And but I guess I would also say, you know, to think about possibilities for change, if we were to be in a world that was less, even now, less rigidly binaristic around gender, then there's tons of jobs out there, of service jobs and of care work jobs that men could be doing. And so trying to think about the sort of cultural change and the economic change coming together, I think, is an important place for work going forward.
Malaika, what would you add?
Well, I have also observed those dynamics, and that is largely, I mean, I would almost say 100% of the reason why I titled my book the way that I did, It's Not You, It's Capitalism, is because we tend to internalize our failures. Living in a hyper-capitalist society like America, we internalize our failures. And a lot of us, we don't have the language or the historical context for how we got here in a society where it's supposedly the richest in the country, but you have so many people struggling under homelessness, so many people who can barely afford rent. And if you want to buy a home, it's more unaffordable now than it has been in the past 40 years. And so the book was a way of saying it's not you. It is an entire system that unfortunately both parties have contributed to, where we are struggling, even if you did everything right, because you probably still have student loan debt. And so I saw a Twitter conversation where there was a man saying that he was already working two jobs. This was about 2 years ago. He was already working two jobs. He still could not pay his rent and he was exhausted. And instead of sympathizing with him, because we have this idea of bootstrapping and individualism in this country, men and women were telling him to man up. Mm. So we have this gendered idea of what financial success is. And the fact that he was even being open about his emotions was feminine. Let alone not able to survive as a breadwinner who could sustain himself. And so I said in my head and probably out loud, it's not you, it's capitalism. And so I think we have to have more empathy for each other. I think for working class people, there's a tendency to just tell people to suck it up. A lot of men and women are internalizing those messages. So how do we then point the focus on political actors, on corporate actors, on the folks who make the decisions to take a lot of these masculine factory jobs or masculine work out of the United States and into other places, other countries or neighborhoods and regions like the South, where they don't have union work. So there is, as we've talked about, these economic concerns that are animating gender. And I don't think that this is, we're doomed to failure. I think there are ways to at least get at some of those problems, even if we can't get at all of them, where we may not need to have Donald Trump after this administration.
You write about this in your piece. You write, a critical mass of men fell off the ledge and into the arms of so-called alpha males with microphones. And here comes Trump barreling back into the White House in a manosphere partly of his own making. So to the man that you just spoke about and so many others who are so angry about their plight, what are your thoughts? Because now we live in a very different media ecosystem. Yeah. Where they can get all of their information from someone like a Joe Rogan, for example, or an angry podcaster who's not talking about the issues you raise, but is just making them angrier. So what are your thoughts on how we pull that back?
Yeah, that's a question, I think, in part of how technology plays into this, because I think for a lot of us, our pre-existing notions are being reinforced through technology. So if we have so many young adults who are getting their news through TikTok, it feeds into an algorithm. So once you start going through one Manosphere video or, you know, Trad Wife video, like, oh, I like this, or I'm curious about this, you're going to start getting a whole lot more of it. So how does this this idea of like rage bait and rage content play into our psyche, especially younger folks who may not have the tools to step away from that. I'm not sure if Professor Salzinger has dealt with this, but a lot of young people are glued to technology and media and social media, and they're not getting some of the other intellectual, they're not in some of the intellectual and academic spaces or reading the things that help them make sense of what they're consuming. So I think we have to think about alternative media. We have to think about maybe not media, but how do we create spaces and community for people to feel supported where just physically they are not glued to their phones? Can we have more investments in libraries and community events? So I think there's like a larger social service aspect to this that goes beyond, you know, just the fact that these things exist, but how do we create other spaces for people to have other ideas?
Hmm. Professor Salzinger, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that being offline in person makes a huge difference to just people's capacity to imagine a different kind of world. And I mean, when I think about my own coming of age as a young person, feminism in person was such an incredibly important space. And I think there's a certain kind of stylistic feminism that we see among young women that doesn't lead to necessarily connection or action going forward. And I think it's just really, really important that people have the experience of working together as a really, you know, as a central part of what they do. I think that's one of the things that's striking about in all the data is the difference between college and non-college educated people in terms of voting. And some of that is just a stand-in for class. Some of that is what happened to people before they got to college. Some of it is the actual politics of college experiences. But I do think the luxury of spending a lot of time with people of your own age, where you're not necessarily having to do labor, is, you know, at that age, is a wonderful thing for people being able to think in connection with other people. And I think that that's really, really going to be essential for anything going forward. And I think the questions that we're dealing with in terms of thinking what's happening with young women and with young men are not going to be the same. And, you know, within that, the differences across class and race are absolutely central. So moving into really talking about different communities in more concrete ways is just going to be absolutely necessary for going forward.
We have so many emails. I just want to make sure I read a few of these. Paul writes, I voted for Jill Stein. I'm a Mexican-American man and couldn't stomach voting for Kamala because of her administration's funding of the genocide in Gaza. The lesser of two evils is not good enough. While people struggle in this economy, the wealthy are flourishing, and Kamala had nothing to say about it. I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I'm sick and tired of the Democrats' lack of an actual plan. They lost this election. It should have been an easy win. Denise writes, I'm sad and scared regarding 45 and 47, talking about Trump. I'm disgusted by his racism and attitude toward women. I live in a senior apartment building where most voted for him. Some older women here do not think it's proper to have a woman president. I was shocked to learn that here in Vallejo, in my beloved California, I'm sad to say it wasn't only a gender thing, but a race thing that influenced their votes. Now I have to live with them, afraid for our public lands, scared for our immigrants. In 4 years, I'll be in my 80s. I'm keeping my passport current, just plain scared. Thank you for that email, Denise, and I'm so sorry you're going through this. Nan writes, young men need to stop whining and blaming women for where they are and where the economy is. Women had to fight for every inch of the rights we now have in the workspace and the political sphere. I've worked in a male field for most of my life. It was not easy, but I never whined about it. I never got paid as much as men in my field, which means I have less in my retirement. And so many other similar emails coming in. There's so much to unpack here, and we're going to do shows about this in the weeks and months to come. And thank you all for sharing your thoughts. Malaika, the conversation is going to continue, but final thoughts for you. I mean, what are you now going to be thinking about and writing about, given what you've heard from people who have written in and what people are just talking about this election?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of fear going into this administration. We know that Project 2025 would allow hospitals to deny emergency life-saving abortions to pregnant patients. It would also coincidentally limit access to birth control. So, you know, we might have a lot more women who are having to endure forced births. So that's just on a policy level. And these things are scary. There's also concerns about just our mentality and the fact that this does seem to be a growing trend and a descent into a more violent and antagonistic misogyny and patriarchy than we've had in the past. And Donald Trump encourages it. But as someone who is a socialist, and I believe in the ability of people changing and being able to motivate people and find solidarity so that we can change the system, I have to believe that there are some ways that we can come together and unite on policy levels. I do not think that misogyny or racism or any of those things will go away overnight. And unfortunately, I think that a Trump presidency and his previous administration helped facilitate this dissent. And we might have a generation trying to undo the harm that he's done. But I believe that folks can find a way to come together, even if it's not everyone, that there are ways to organize politically, there are ways to organize socially, where you can get enough people where you do not have to repeat history.
Well, we will definitely continue this conversation. Malaika Jabali and Professor Leslie Salzinger, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Thank you for having us.